We're making a case last night for comparative religion, the importance of a study of world religions, not so much in terms of comparative religions, which Ronald Knox said comparative religion makes people comparatively religious, but really in a sense of what that means for world views, for world awareness, for cultural consciousness, for the contrast of thought which helps us to become more familiar with and better able to understand our own faith. In this connection, there is on reserve a book by Ninian Smart called World Views, Cross-Cultural Understanding. And they have that book also in the bookstore, so that if you'd like, you could take a look at that. I think it's fairly new, and it's a very good piece of work, I think. It's not organized in anything like the way I'm talking about world religions, so it's not a matter of repeating anything that you would have heard. In fact, he says a lot of things, very bright things that I don't even know, unless I read them in Ninian Smart's book. He's the man that produced the series of films on world religion called The Long Journey. I don't know if any of you have seen them. They showed some of those films here at Holden 2 weeks ago. When someone was here talking from Valpo, talking about non-Christian religions. Ninian Smart, World Views. He says, and Smart said something that I didn't know before, that the study of world religions or comparative religion is a relatively new field. I first heard about this whole thing through the efforts of one Professor Marcus Bach, at the University of Iowa. That's a very important place. You should all remember, University of Iowa. Iowa City, Iowa. It's an in thing. Some of us are alumni of the University of Iowa, and more than once. But Bach, way back when I was an undergraduate in the School of Religion, was studying comparative religions and teaching them. And everybody thought it was kind of a snap course, and people thought it was kind of a strange and esoteric and probably not very important. But since that time, a number of scholars have been doing work, and it has been an important kind of scholarly inquiry. So when you look at Smart, you will be looking at some of the most recent and responsible work that's done. He teaches at University of California, Santa Barbara, and at the University of Lancaster in England, and University of California, Santa Barbara, is where Robert Michelson is, who also was at the University of Iowa years ago as a director of the School of Religion. Well, I think we're going to turn on that projector pretty quick and get started with some slides. The bargain is that when you approach something like world religions, there's no longer court. Okay. Then would you take that, and when I ask you to advance the thing, it's the top button.
I'm just delighted.
The way to do this is to look and see. And so many of you are world travelers or museum goers that it's really kind of important to learn how to look at works of art. Now, the pictures I'm going to show you tonight mostly are altar pieces. That's why we could talk of the eye and the spirit tonight under the theme painting as high chancel drama. That's kind of a pun. But the pictures that you will see will be mostly altar pieces, mostly Christian, because that's the simplest iconography for us to catch on to. Iconography is just a fancy word for meaning, for identifying what you see in the picture. Iconography is reading the pictures, and the material, the visual content in the picture is its iconography. And that's a fascinating study just in itself, because when you walk through a museum, if you know the vocabulary of the saints, if you know the attributes of the saints, you will always know that that figure holding the keys is St. Peter. You know that the figure with a big wheel is St. Catherine, Catherine's wheel. And if you don't know, you just simply go to the Book of Saints and read about the lives of these people, and pretty soon you begin to catch on. Very, very interesting study in and of itself, iconography is. But we're going to talk about some of that tonight and try to continue the idea that it is these sacred images which make the world, as we understand the world, as Christians understand the world. We're just going to be talking about that tonight. And you will have a chance to read all these pictures because they're as familiar to you as Christmas cards are. They mean the same kind of thing. I mean the cordial remembrance of the event of the incarnation, and the blessing that visitation of our Lord makes. That's what this stuff is all about too. It's an aid to the devotions, an aid to the worship of the people who assembled before these altarpieces. So let's take a look. These are not museum pieces, although I guess that the pictures that you're going to be seeing are all in museums at one place or another. I think many of these are from the Metropolitan Museum in New York. This is Robert Campan, an altarpiece of the Annunciation, painted, it's a Flemish painter. All of these pictures are roughly contemporaneous with Luther, from about 1425 or something like that, maybe 50 years before Luther was born, up until about 1550. These pictures mostly are drawn from a period called the Northern Renaissance, Flemish. I think every one I've got tonight is Flemish, partly because that art is so didactic. That means that the art is so bent on teaching you. It is so bent on telling you the truth. It is so bent on being theologically accurate. And we'll see enough Italian samples to see the difference. Over there, you see Joseph, the carpenter, right? The very simple carpenter shop. Back here is a genre scene, just an ordinary scene from a Dutch village. You see the shutters on the window, and they're open in this case. Joseph often, in these pictures, is depicted as being quite unaware of what's going on. True to the biblical story, you know, he didn't understand what this scene all meant. Here's Mary, his betrothed, reading her missal, and it's being held with a cloth to keep it clean. I don't think that's necessarily a symbol of sanctity. There's your symbol of sanctity, the lilies in the vase, which you will find inevitably in a picture of the Annunciation. Most often, dividing the picture and dividing the figure of the angel from Mary. This is an immaculate conception that's going on. And the lilies have to do with the purity. The candle is snuffed out. I think that's because the presence of God is already there. A lighted candle in medieval pictures usually means that God is present. I think that this, I'm not positive about this, but I think that this marvelous painting of that brass kettle hanging there is a reference to the vessel that Mary's obedience is. And then the Archangel Gabriel. And skimming down out of the window over here, the rays. And you will see as we move on, let's take the next one, I think, Mary, please. Some details you will see here, a little spirit with a cross, as though that is, and usually the rays of the spirit are seven, for the sevenfold gifts of the spirit. That's the kind of theological, didactic accuracy that these people put into the pictures. Once again, here's a beautiful towel hanging here. Mary is just an ordinary Flemish girl. If you've been to Flanders, you've been to that part of Northern Europe, you recognize that high forehead and the shallow set eyes. The book on the table is a very affluent place, painted on a very narrow ground. You don't have very much depth in this picture, and you notice how that table tilts forward, the bench tilts. There isn't much room. But here's the concentration is mostly on these two figures, although you could isolate any of these details and have rather a beautiful, accurate still life. That bronze candlestick is really bronze. You know, it's that kind of tactile painting. The sheen of the hair and the weight and the fold of the draperies. Let's go on to the next one, Mary. There are a couple more details here which you should see. There you can see the kind of still life effect that you find in the vase holding the lilies. There is a smoke and the candle just faint as melted wax running down one side. You see how that bench tilts up, carved figures at the end. The textures, silver, brass, cloth, paper, leaves, wood, are all very individualized. Extremely skillful painting. Let's go ahead to the next one there. There is a detail of the descent of the Spirit. Cruciform in this case. That's unusual, that cross. Most of the time it's a dove. And then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 rays, right? You see 7 rays? Let's go on to the next one. That's Robert Campin. That's a detail of the village scene. That's the background from Joseph. A shutter is here. This one is open over there. And out there you see in the same kind of a tilt-up perspective, village church. This one's seen straight on. That one's seen as though you're looking up at the tower. But so skillfully done, so well put together, you wouldn't have noticed that probably unless I pointed it out to you. In fact, I hadn't seen it until I saw it this large. Step gables on the houses, just like in Holland, those high-pitched roofs. You see that stepping up gable, just like Amsterdam. And then people walking on the streets, just doing ordinary things. A woman over here sweeping her porch. Just to compare, hold that scene in your mind while we look at the next one, which is a photograph I took It's a photograph of the German Romanesque cathedral at Bamberg. And I put that in just simply because this is an actual photograph that somehow compares with the accuracy of that landscape. Let's go on to the next one. The Visitation by Roger van der Weyden. And you all know who this figure is. That's Mary. She's wearing blue. And she's visiting her cousin Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. And here they are, touching each other because they're both pregnant. And this is very, very quiet, serene remembrance of that meeting. Now, why it's outdoors on that winding hillside, I really can't tell you. It may have something to do with the painting that this is a detail of, because this may be one panel of another altarpiece, and I can't tell you, and my scholarship isn't good enough tonight to tell you the answer to that question. But look at this marvelous hillside, and then let's look at the detail. The next slide, which shows that fellow sitting at that gate, gives you an idea of how meticulously, carefully painted these were. And it's not large. You can see, if you're close enough, a lot of cracks in the paint here, which means this is painted in oil on wood, and it's enlarged many, many times from what you're seeing. The whole altarpiece probably wouldn't be much larger than this screen, and this is one small section of it. Let's go on to the next one. This is Italian, Fra Angelico, and it is, of course, the Nativity. Following that Annunciation and the Visitation, you come to the Nativity. This is Italian now, it's Florentine. And you see some angels standing on a straw roof. And that straw roof is very generalized compared to the detail you've been seeing in these Flemish pictures. This is Italian, remember? The Italians were the Italian classic, serene, balanced, symmetrical, like this, symmetrical. We're not as interested in that kind of detail. This is very linear. You could take a scissors and you could cut that figure out without any trouble at all. That's a characteristic of Florentine painting, that kind of linear depiction. It's also characteristic of Northern painting. Plateresque halos. You see those halos. They look like gold plates stuck behind the person's head. There isn't that much interest really in perspective here, although there's a good bit of ground between that point and the foreground where the baby Jesus with his cruciform, get that? The red palms of the cross on the halo behind. Only the Spirit, only the Savior had that cruciform halo. That cruciform halo belongs to the Godhead. Saints will have this kind of halo. And a square one means a living saint. That's rare, but you see it once in a while. The baby just lying there naked, and Joseph and Mary in adoration. Mary's hands are in prayer. Joseph's hands are in a gesture somewhere between prayer and kind of wonderment that this whole thing is taking place. And the ox and the ass are just peeking at the scene. Let's go on to one more detail of that very beautiful, that beautiful linear face. Look at that. That line just flows all the way around that face of Mary. Okay, that's an Italian statement of the Nativity. These are angels of the Nativity, painted by a Flemish painter, Gerard David, and they say his name, David, in order to distinguish him from a French 19th century painter that art historians usually call David. But anyway, this guy was painting the angels of the Nativity. This is only a detail. But you see that same careful attention to drapery is contrasted with feathers, highly decorated, marvelous, voluminous draperies. Those robes, if you put them on, would really keep you warm. They're very heavy. They look like monk's cloth or a very heavy alb. They're singing. This is a joyous picture. You don't see a lot of smiles and grins, but that's a joyful conglomerate. You look at the rhythm of those wings. You see those wings going all the way through the picture, and that busy rhythm sets you to remembering with some sense the glee of the heavenly chorus as they sang at the Savior's birth. There's some more David pictures. Let's go on to the next one. This one is his adoration of the shepherds. You see, now the adoration of the shepherds is different from the Nativity, is different from the adoration of the Magi, even though in every case you'll have Mary and Joseph. Here's Joseph with his little candle warming his hand. The angels are very, very small, kind of crowding in to see that little baby lying on the fold of Mary's robe. Rocks, a kind of a ruined structure here. There isn't very much ground there. If you were to make a ground plan, you'd draw Joseph like that, a couple of angels here, Mary over here. The baby is at the center, but there's not the same interest of balance and symmetry in this that you find in Italian pictures. Here, looking through this reference to antiquity, a rounded arch, you see, some knowledge of all of that. And the shepherds looking in wonderment. These are crude, kind of ordinary peasant types. They don't have the same holy serenity or the nobility of these figures, the holy figures. And then back here, the scene opens out into a hillside and a town and a castle keep and then orchards and trees and then in the far distance, more mountains. That's not the way Flanders is, because Flanders is flat. But you see, this is an imaginary way of saying this took place in some long distant scene long ago, and the ox and the ass are off to one side. I think there's a detail of this one too. The detail is of that shepherd looking in with a look of real surprise. What's going on here? And then you see these beautiful plains, colored plains of the town back there, and the leaves put together. I mean, this was a design scene. You wouldn't have seen that scene. It occurred in the imagination of the artist. This one is Jerome Bosch, who painted some lurid scenes of hell, which would be fun to look at, but I don't have those slides. This is the adoration of the Magi. Mary, now this time holding the baby, not lying on the ground, but holding the baby, because these kings have come to visit. These kings have come to bring the frankincense and gold and myrrh. You remember the names? Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar, one of whom, look way back there in the 16th century, they were aware that one of these kings, by legend, was a black man. You find that black king oftentimes in this period of art. Joseph is over here, very old man in this picture. King's got his crown, and Mary is just holding a child so the kings can see him and adore him, the ox and the ass, and the angels, in a ruined building. The idea was a long time ago, and the building is quite ruined to say it's ancient. The angels are very considerately holding a canopy here so that rain or snow or whatever doesn't fall on the holy child. And you know that it's wintertime because the shepherds back here are warming their hands over a fire that's burning in this brazier back here. And you see quite a depth of ground in this one. That perspective goes quite a way back, opens out onto an ordinary scene here at a town, and people dancing and walking, and shepherd tending flocks, and somebody crossing a bridge in minute detail, characteristic of the Northern Renaissance.
Is there some significance that in all these pictures the baby is always naked and the people are wearing heavy clothes?
Well, I suspect that it is because they accentuate the idea of nativity, mm-hmm. the nakedness of the child, he's just been born. Mm-hmm. There isn't that much sense of time lapse. You see, we tend in our day to think more of time sequence than these people did. Mm-hmm. They just took it as though it were one page after another in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that in all of the Flemish paintings that you've shown so far, there have been no halos. Is that characteristic?
That's interesting. I was ruminating about that this afternoon because I kept looking for the halos in Flemish painting, and I think it may be as much the period as anything. Because at the very end, I've got a picture from the Ghent altarpiece, which is about 1425, and then that Mary has a plateresque halo. Bosch and these people were 16th century, early 16th century artists. This is the way people were painting in Flanders just before the Reformation, when Luther was alive. I'd have to look for that. I'm not positive. Maybe I can find something out about that before tomorrow or before Thursday. Let's go on to the next one. I think we have a detail of this Bosch scene. Yeah, there you see the crowns. It's a very elegant turban and an elegant tiara on top of that. And these marvelous ciboria, or whatever they would be called, containers for the gifts. This with an eagle on it. An egg-shaped thing, and this one was ciborium, very much like you would find on an altar holding the host at that time, probably. Here's a shepherd out here. There's that person walking the dog across the stream. I'm not sure that at this distance I can't tell whether it's a fish jumping or what exactly that object is. Here's a shepherd. Look at this guy looking you right in the eye, wondering probably if you get the significance of what it is that's going on. His companion is more interested in his cold fingers. But you see that? You see this intricate detail? All of those bricks with the cracks. The masonry is carefully depicted there. Were we to see some others, we'd see that same kind of detail, not in the boards on the floor, but you could read the designs of the tiles on the floor in perspective.
It's interesting, that looks like more like a shepherd's staff without a shepherd. It's up against a pot or something, isn't it? And then there's also a skeleton that the crows are biting.
You're right. Against. You're right. That's not a figure over there. That's a pot, and it's got a cane or a staff or something through it.
And then there's the skeleton.
And there's a skeleton. Skeleton of an animal of some kind, it looks like, and the crows or the ravens are taking good care of it quickly. But this would be typical of this particular painter, who like Bruegel, paints ordinary kinds of scenes, very earthy, what later will be called genre pictures. This man has some of the most vivid scenes of temptations and judgments and hell that you'll ever see. Okay, let's go on quickly to the next one. Italian, once again, Giovanni di Paolo, and here you find an Italian expression of what is it? Who knows? Who can read it?
Presentation.
The presentation of the temple. Joseph, Mary, you see them because they have the halos. Saint Simeon, and there's the baby Jesus. Back here is a priest with a Jewish kind of headdress, I take it. But this looks very much like a baptismal font. But here is a presentation in the temple. And this is clearly a baptistry. That's an Italianate baptistry with these long, slender columns. You saw those slender columns in the other Italian that we saw, with these intricately worked semi-Corinthian, something like Corinthian capitals. Even the inside of the vaulting, here are the ribs from the vaulting shown. Perspective isn't quite that sophisticated here yet. This very elegant Florentine lady with this elaborate headdress and that flowing profile, very, very graceful, slender, delicate hands, very finely done. The tiles are bright colored tiles of the kind that you would see in Italy. This rusticated lower level of the palace, very much like you'd see in Florence, with decorative pediments, or whatever these things are called, holding up another story. You can see something like this on the palace in Milan. I can't remember, Sforza Palace in Milan. Texture very much like that. It's a very Italian kind of expression. What's going on in this scene is very quiet, calm atmosphere with everybody waiting. Simeon is looking at the blessing. Here's the blessing, and he's holding the hope of the nations in his arms. Now he can depart in peace. Now this is Italian, and you just have to look at it for a moment or two to see that even though a lot of this detail is worked in, it's nothing as intricately or as carefully observed and rendered as you find in Flemish painting. Italian painting is characterized a little bit by a greater generality, I would call it. And Flemish painting, Northern painting, tends to be more specific in its direction. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Dutchman, Adrian... Obviously, the flight. As soon as the baby was born, they had to flee. You might wonder sometime about the significance of the fact that right after Christmas in the church year, 2 days immediately following, you have the martyrdom of Stephen and the massacre of the innocents. It's as though our fathers and God are telling us by the arrangement of the lessons that this is a cruel world. No sooner does the Savior come than all the brutality sets in again the very next day. And it's expensive to be a Christian. And fatal for some. Fatal for many, as it turns out. Here's Joseph. You see that old man. The legend is that Joseph is an old person. Mary is a young person. And once again, Ed, no halos. But what you do find is a gem of a landscape. Look at that beautiful glowing house, contrasting these brilliant colors with the dark trees, the dark of a heavy forest. Look at the bark on that tree. You can almost feel the roughness. Mary protecting the baby, very small, very young mother, riding along, this very silent kind of thing. And Joseph plodding along to safety in Egypt. And the landscape looks nothing like Egypt, of course. The castle on the Rhine, that's what it looks like. A castle up here in the hills on this side. Flight into Egypt. Let's take another one, please. There's the Virgin And there you see a genre scene back here. There's the gate, the road, the gate, somebody in the yard doing something, ordinary scene of doing chores, while the Holy Family goes on down the road. It's a marvelous statement of religious piety in the midst of ordinary life, in the midst of just ordinary goings-on. It's as though to say, Christ really did come to this earth. He really did dwell, not just in ideal ways or not just in abstract ways, but boy, that baby was really there in front of that really very true farmhouse at one time. Strong sense of that kind of realism in this Flemish painting. Okay, see what the next one is, just for fun. It's a detail once again. There you find Mary from the Ghent altarpiece. And I take it back, Ed, that's not a halo, that's the crown. Mary, this is Mary's crown. That's the background, the border of the arch in front of which she sits. But I thought I'd show you this one because this is somewhat earlier than any of those that you've seen. This painting, this whole altarpiece is attributed to Hubert and Jan van Eyck, although scholars don't know which one of those brothers painted which of the figures in this thing. But this is Mary, Queen of Heaven, seated to the left of a figure that is the deity. We'll see that one tomorrow when I want to show you pictures of deity in comparative ways. But the figure in the center, Mary leaning in this way, there's a figure in the center. On that side, in a similar frame as this, with a lesson written in Latin above, is John the Baptist looking in on the scene. The central figure is probably God the Father, although, and you probably know that because he wears a papal tiara, three-layered crown. The impact of that, though, is the Trinity, the Holy Trinity. All of them together in one. The Van Eycks painted 1410, 1415, something like that. This is oil on wood, and these are some of the first experiments with oil painting, because prior to this time, a lot of the painting was tempera, pigment mixed with egg yolk and then brushed on in very thin layers. What oil does, the oil is much slower drying, but it allows people to put on underpainting, gives a luminescence to jewels like this. I mean, those are pearls, aren't they? I mean, they look like pearls, and this is a ruby or an amethyst, and it's really got that kind of glow to it. And there are gold threads on her bodice, once again, this marvelous, fine treatment of hair. It just glows, and when you get up close, in northern painting, you can see individual hairs, finely painted. And that magnificent crown with lilies for purity and roses, and then the jewels all the way through. Mary, indeed, young, reading her book, clad in blue, it could only be Mary, a young girl, Queen of Heaven. And that's the theological significance that this is intended to convey.
But reading Latin.
Pardon me?
Reading Latin.
Yep, reading Latin, I'm sure. And you could check it too, you know, if we were close enough or we were able, you could probably make out at least some of these words. And there's an M, that's for sure. And it could be the text, usually was, when you see these paintings, the text that you can see and read is usually associated with the biblical text that identifies a person. And we can't get, maybe somebody can from where you're sitting, decipher what this Latin is. You surely can when you see the whole picture. Let's go one more. I think I have just one more. This is an Eastern version of the Virgin Mary. I mean, you can't miss it. It's obviously that kind of thing. Only this one is, unlike the altarpieces we've been looking at, an aid to devotion because this one is an icon. The icon is that depiction of divinity, which is the substitute for or represents the presence of that divinity. An icon is, as I was trying to claim last week, that composition which makes God present even though he's absent, which allows God to speak even though God is silent. It functions not only as an illustration, not only as an aid to worship, not only as a reminder of what we're doing here. The icon really participates in that holy liturgy. It is itself venerated, and we're skating on thin ice because I don't know that much about Orthodox piety except to know that people kiss these pictures, handle these pictures, and believe that they receive protection from these pictures as though the Lord were actually present. They're carried through the streets, processions, and sometimes these pictures have been carried in front of the army or in front of the people confronting the enemy, and the enemy is defeated. They're very sacred in a way that we Westerners don't get. But here you find a typical Madonna derived from a Byzantine tradition, derived from Byzantium, derived from the East, Constantinople. An expression of wealth and piety that had to do with the long-lasting Roman Empire. The empire in the East. Star, this Alexandrian star here and here, are typical of these Madonnas. And that marvelous flowing border on her drape is more typical. I mean, it's repeated over and over and over again. Repeated in this fashion, the baby in this fashion. There's hardly any change from one Madonna to the next. Because that tradition is so strong. When we looked at Campan and these other people in the north, we were seeing a pleasant, fresh-faced girl, peasant girl, a very naturalistic girl. And there were differentiations, even though the poses were the same, even though the thought was the same, the costume was similar. Here, you don't find that much differentiation because these pictures don't intend to be that imitation of life, that imitation of what a young girl looks like. These are theologically accurate statements about the hierarchy of heaven. Heavily worked. There's practically no background. A gold background, which is typical in the West, in Florentine painting until I suppose 1400, but maintained in Byzantine art for a long, long time. A heavily worked frame, which is a part of the icon. And that's all there is to it. The pictures stand, and the iconostasis, which is a kind of rude screen. It's a screen between the people as they assemble and what we think of as the chancel of the church. This iconostasis is filled with the sacred pictures. Sometimes the sacred pictures go down both walls. But that separates the people from the holy mysteries. The priest goes behind this iconostasis, and inside those gates he consecrates the elements and then brings them out. These are the holy mysteries of Orthodoxy. Well, those are the pictures that I have to show you to give us an idea tonight about iconography and reading pictures. Now, I hope on Thursday to be able to sort out some of these and show you pictures of sacred space, some of the divinities, and some of the representations of theological significance. We'll see whether that works on Thursday or not. Okay, lights. What time is it now? 1:45. I have to depart this room promptly at 2:05, but we have that much time for comments and questions. If there are some that you'd like to raise. The only trouble with this device is that that is so heavy, it keeps pulling this off my shirt. Otherwise, we've got a perfect recording. Yes, please.
I'd just like to comment on the icon. We live in a town where there are many, many Russian old believers, and they have a shrine practically every household.
Yep.
The icon is their shrine.
Yep.
Pardon me?
Icons are found in homes.
Oh, yes. Yes. My mother and father-in-law just bought a house in Appleton, Wisconsin from a Greek Orthodox family. And I think in half the rooms as we walked through that house, there were depictions of St. George and the Dragon. That's one of the big ones.
St. George.
Yeah.
What was that date on the last icon that you gave? Did you give a date?
I don't have a date on that, but I think it's 17th century, I believe.
They haven't changed much.
Then. Oh, no. That's one of the amazing things. You can look at these things from 800, from 1100 to 1700 and they're very, very similar.
I noticed, too, in this period, the artist had not yet acquired the sense of perspective that later artists did.
In that icon?
In any of the ones you showed, the perspective is off. Already had not.
That's an Italian convention.
Well,
first
even
of all.
The Flemish painters had not acquired that sense of perspective, really. I mean, there wasn't a real realistic sense of depth yet.
That's right.
I think who was it that first, Da Vinci, who starts to do that development?
Well,
maybe
it depends. You're seeing some very skillful aerial perspective in these Flemish pictures.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. Linear perspective, or the 1-point, 2-point perspective, it gives you the sense of depth on which this scene takes place, is really not very well developed until you get further on into, what's your guess? You were going to...
No.
I think that... You have it in 17th century Dutch painters, Peter de Hoogh and Jan Vermeer. They're very, very skillful perspective. But I don't think. See, I guess you have to say that in these paintings, Campan, Roger van der Weyden, Peter and Derek Boots, and some of these folks, they weren't really interested in that anyway. They were interested enough to show you a shelf because. At least in the Annunciation of Jan van Eyck that's in Washington, that tilting of the floor will help you read the tiles that prefigure the thing that's going on. The defeat of Samson and these pictures, biblical pictures, are on the tiles in the floor. And if he did it in a true perspective, he'd be less advantaged in showing you that. So they had something. And of course, in Byzantine, it's all reverse. Perspective, they don't intend to do anything except a flat scene. In Italy, where does a perspective start? Salvatore Rosa was a great one for Leonardo. Leonardo didn't paint that much. You know, his pictures tend to be only that kind of aerial and landscape perspective that you've seen here. I don't know who it was in Italy perspective. They're great ones when they get to. Who's the guy that made all these? Pisano. Piranesi is the one. I think he makes these marvelous interiors. That comes along more with Baroque art, I think. Higher instincts. Yes, somebody else had a comment.
Well, I had heard that some of these painters knew quite a lot about perspective, but in a way to create a feeling of almost omniscience in looking at it, they mixed perspectives. I mean, you're looking down and looking down on something and at the same time looking up at something.
Yeah.
With some kind of mixed perspectives.
Yeah, Jane Dillenberger, in a book that's here in the library, discusses that in a resurrection scene. That's painted by, can't remember, first off, and I'll think of it in a minute. But in this resurrection scene, Jesus, this is a very didactic painting. Jesus is standing with one foot on the tomb, on the edge of the tomb. The Roman soldiers are lying here sleeping on this side. One of them is just awakened. But you're looking at the perspective eye level at this foot and these soldiers down here. And when you move up, you're looking at eye level at the face of Jesus here. The intention, and maybe it's unconscious, the intention of the artist in organizing his two-dimensional plane is to show you something, depict something, in these cases, accurately. And he probably does these things without ever imagining. And of course, with synthesized compositions like this, you put the picture of Joseph in his workshop here, but you have all that space up above to fill, and you paint that landscape out there. You're not painting it in connection with what you just painted as Joseph in his workshop. Even though his workbench tilts like that, you couldn't keep his screwdriver out very long. It would roll right off. But perspective is one of those late conventions that aids a naturalistic kind of imitation, and it just, I don't think it was terribly important to these folks.